Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 29, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear about the decision in the Supreme Court case, Star Athletica v. Varsity Brands. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Sandra A. Stars, Clinical Professor and Senior Scholar and Director of Copyright Research and Policy of CPIP at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. I will turn it over to Professor A. Stars to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much. Thanks to all of the members of the Federalist Society for having me on the teleforum today. I will start first by reviewing the basic holding and the background of the case quickly. Then I'll walk through the opinion more carefully, noting some of the more interesting and important points in the Supreme Court's opinion. And then finally, I'll say a few words about the implications of the decision. I haven't timed out my remarks, but my guess is that it'll take about 30 or so minutes to get through all of this. I guess we can hold questions to the end. That might be easier than trying to identify people on a conference call as we're going through. So just to review the basics, Varsity Brands, a manufacturer of cheerleading uniforms, sued Star Athletica, one of its competitors, alleging copyright infringement of designs appearing on its cheerleading uniforms. This happened in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Tennessee, and the original holding was in favor of Star Athletica. Varsity then appealed to the Sixth Circuit and prevailed in the Sixth Circuit. And the Supreme Court took the case to resolve a long-standing mess amongst the circuits on how to resolve the so-called separability test. Under Section 101 of the Copyright Act, the design of a useful article, such as a garment, is protectable only to the extent that it incorporates pictorial, graphic, or sculptural features that can be identified separately from and are capable of existing independently of the utilitarian aspects of the article. And that's the separability test that the court seeks to define better in this opinion. As I said, courts around the country have developed 9 different approaches to this issue. And in handing down the 6-2 opinion of the Supreme Court, Justice Thomas, who wrote for the majority, announced a test that, not surprisingly for the justice, sticks close to the statutory language of the Copyright Act. The test, which is simpler than any that the courts around the country have been applying, says that a feature incorporated into the design of a useful article is eligible for copyright protection if the feature, one, can be perceived as a 2D or a 3D work of art separate from the useful article, and two, would qualify as a pictorial, sculptural, or graphic work, either on its own or fixed in some other medium of expression, if it was imagined separately from the useful article into which it was incorporated. There were 2 other opinions, other than the majority, a concurring opinion from Justice Ginsburg, who said that while she agreed with the test set forth, there was really no need to reach the question of separability in this case, because what Varsity had registered with the Copyright Office was a 2D work, and that 2D design had been applied to an article of clothing, so no separability test needed here. And then there was a dissenting opinion drafted by Justice Breyer and joined by Justice Kennedy, and while they said they found much to agree with in the majority's opinion, they could not extract the designs from the utilitarian work. They said that Varsity's designs conform to the shape of the clothing to which they were applied. So they could not exist as a two-dimensional artwork separate from the underlying garment. Both justices, in their dissenting opinion, also raised questions about the implications for broader copyright policy of the majority's decision. So turning to the actual opinion of the Supreme Court and walking through it a little bit more closely, starting with the holding of the majority is that a feature incorporated into the design of a useful article is eligible for copyright protection only if the feature can be perceived as a two- or three-dimensional work of art separate from the useful article, and two, would qualify as a protectable work either on its own or fixed in some other medium if it were imagined separately from the useful article. And because they found that that test was met, they affirmed the lower court's opinion. I will not go through the history in any further depth in the district court or the Sixth Circuit opinions, but those are somewhat entertaining to read if you're a copyright lawyer and want to read about the existential issues facing people who wear cheerleading uniforms and whether a uniform can exist apart from its chevrons and stripes and zigzags, or whether it just becomes a little black dress or a little white dress. But in any event, turning to the actual Supreme Court's analysis in this case, the first question that they had to reach was whether they even need to address the separability analysis in this case. Varsity argued that separability is only implicated when a pictorial, graphic, or sculptural work is the design of a useful article. And they argued that the surface decorations in the case at hand were two-dimensional graphic designs that appeared on a useful article, and therefore they're not designs of useful articles, and there's no separability analysis necessary. So it's a question of versus on in their estimation, and that's also the reasoning that Justice Ginsburg gave in her concurring opinion. The Supreme Court majority opinion dismissed with that pretty quickly, saying that that view is inconsistent with the text of Section 101 of the Copyright Act, that the Act requires analysis of the separability test when a PSG work, a pictorial, sculptural, or graphic work is incorporated into the design of a useful article, and therefore moved quite quickly into the meat of the argument. So the first thing that the court says in its before getting to its analysis is that they are not here engaged in a free-ranging search for the best copyright policy, but rather looking to do a straightforward statutory interpretation, which is an interesting commentary, I think, given the opinion of the majority and the opinion of the two dissenting justices. And we can talk about that in the Q&A, perhaps. So looking to the whole provisions of the Copyright Act to determine the meaning of Section 101, the court goes through its analysis and looks to the first element and says the first thing you must do is spot a 2D or a 3D element with pictorial, graphic, or sculptural qualities. This is a fairly easy thing to do in the court's estimation. They identify the surface decorations that are submitted as designs as such. The second element, the independent existence requirement, the court says is typically more difficult to satisfy. And it explains that in order to satisfy this test, one must determine that an element can exist on its own as a pictorial, sculptural, or graphic work once imagined apart from the useful article. If it can't exist on its own, then that must mean that it was one of the utilitarian aspects of the article, and it therefore should not qualify for protection. The court finally turns to the whole of the act to confirm that their interpretation of the announced test is correct. And looking at Section 101 and Section 113A together, the court observes that they're really mirror images of one another and confirms that copyright protection extends to pictorial, sculptural, and graphic works, whether they're created as freestanding art or features of useful articles, and that ultimately the question is whether a feature would have been eligible for copyright protection if it were originally fixed in some other medium other than a useful article. Applies the test to the works at issue in this particular case, the court says, you know, this test in this instance is really quite easy. The decorations are features having pictorial, sculptural, or graphic qualities. That's the first element. Second, if they were imagined separately and applied in another medium, like a painter's canvas, they would qualify as two-dimensional works of art without replicating the uniform itself. And Varsity has, in fact, applied designs to other clothing, so the works meet both elements of the test and are eligible for copyright protection. Notably, the court drops a footnote here and says, you know, they don't hold that the surface decorations are copyrightable, however. And that is because there are other elements that must be met, such as being sufficiently original to qualify for copyright protection. And there are numerous other prerequisites for valid copyright that may or may not be satisfied in this case. So it's entirely possible that the case could, on remand to the Western District of Tennessee, be decided on the merits, on the facts before the court differently. A couple of things to note as the court rebuts the dissent. It notes that it's not a bar to copyrightability that a two-dimensional work, when extracted and imagined separately from the three-dimensional work, retains the contours of the utilitarian object that it had been applied to. The court talks about situations such as, you know, imagine a fresco on a wall or a ceiling panel or a dome. These works of art, the court says, would not lose copyright protection simply because they were designed to track the dimensions of the surface on which they were painted. Or consider if there was a design etched or painted on the surface of a guitar, if the entire design was removed from the guitar's surface and it was placed on an album cover, it would still resemble the shape of the guitar on the album cover, but the image on the cover doesn't replicate a guitar as a useful article. And so it's a two-dimensional work of art that corresponds to a shape of a useful article to which it was once applied, and therefore it's different from the useful article that does not get copyright protection. Only the 2D work of art gets copyright protection. That was the issue that the dissenting opinion struggled with, is how to separate the utilitarian functions, particularly in the 3D world, from these 2D features, decorative features, in some harder cases that we might see coming up. Two other things that are worth noting, and I think will be important in future cases, and these were said in dismissing some of Star Athletica's arguments. One was that the court noted that the useful article need not remain useful after this extraction of the decorative features are done. Star had argued that copyright should extend only to solely artistic features of useful articles, and the court rejected that argument. The court also rejected the argument that the government had made. The government had said that the appropriate test would be whether the useful article with the artistic feature removed would remain similarly useful. And in the government's brief, they had argued that while you could take the chevrons and stripes and zigzags off of the uniform and be left with a plain white cheerleading uniform, would that uniform be similarly useful to uniforms with the respondents' designs on them, Varsity's designs on them? The majority opinion said the focus needs to be on the features that you're extracting, not on the remaining aspects of the useful article. So the statute doesn't require that you have to imagine a fully functioning useful article once the artistic feature is taken away. It did so in part because some of the important underlying case law that had helped to develop this doctrine would have fallen by the wayside had this argument requiring solely artistic features be protectable, or only solely artistic features be protectable, that Star was advancing taken hold. It would have abrogated the Mazur case, which if any of you are familiar with it, this was one of the original cases where a lamp base was composed of a statuette. And this case was one of the first cases that applied this doctrine, and on which basis the Act has also evolved. So because the court decided that no useful article has to remain once these artistic elements are extracted, the court was able in its decision here to abandon also this distinction that had grown up in the circuit courts between physical and conceptual separability. And that to me is one of the more confounding and challenging analyses that the courts have had to go through in this space. So this decision from the Supreme Court, I hope, should clarify the test and make it a little bit easier to apply. The court also rejected a variety of other additional tests that Star advanced because they simply weren't in the statute, and ended also by noting, importantly, that despite Starr's arguments that Congress had intended to exclude industrial design from copyright protection in drafting the 1976 Copyright Act, and had in numerous cases rejected bills that would have extended copyright protection to fashion and to other types of industrial design, Congress does not signal its intent merely by rejecting or not enacting legislation, that alone is not sufficient to carry the day as far as STAR's arguments are concerned, and more importantly, that patents and copyright protections are not mutually exclusive. So the Supreme Court's test and the possibility that additional copyright protections be extended in this situation is fully consistent with congressional intent. And so that is the majority opinion. The concurring opinion by Ginsburg is very short, and as I've said already, basically, she focuses on the concept that the designs at issue are not designs of useful articles. Instead, the designs are themselves copyrightable works reproduced on useful articles, and therefore getting to the separability test was unwarranted. She also agrees on withholding judgment as to whether designs are otherwise copyrightable, but notes that the requisite level of creativity that's needed to establish originality and to obtain copyright protection is quite low. So she is not as convinced as some of her brethren that Varsity might have a challenge in the lower court. And then finally, getting to Breyer and Kennedy's dissenting opinion, their real focus was that even applying the majority's tests, they could not perceive the designs as separate two-dimensional works of art from the uniform. And they noted also that Varsity submitted drawings of cheerleading uniforms in order to get copyright protection. So the design features that Varsity was seeking to protect are not capable of existing independently of the utilitarian aspects of the article. They go through many arguments that have been considered, I think, in some of the other instances where the separability test has been proposed. They also note, as did Star Athletica, that Congress has repeatedly rejected proposals for broad copyright protections for the fashion industry, and that there are other IP protections available to the fashion industry, such as design patents and trademarks for signature features of clothing, and original textiles can get copyright protection. And so additional copyright protection may be unnecessary for this this particular instance. That is the crux of the dissent is really on not so much the test itself, but the application of the test to the facts here. So quickly turning to the implications of this test and to the implications of this opinion for not just the fashion industry, but for other industries. I'll say a couple of words about those issues and then open the floor for questions. Some commentators on tech and IP blogs have been setting this test up as a copyright first versus utility first kind of argument. So that the that the opinion of the court has really handed down a copyright first kind of test, that you remove all the elements that can be perceived as two or three dimensional works of art. And since the object that's remaining doesn't have to function, that could lead to a result that all or virtually all of a utilitarian work could be copyright protected if the design was sufficiently creative. And the folks who are more skeptical of IP protections or more conservative about protecting elements of industrial design in particular would argue that you should really do the flip, that you should remove, when you're imagining this separability test, you should remove all functional elements and protect only the remaining elements of a work with copyright. And the result obviously would be the reverse. You could render nothing or virtually nothing protectable by copyright in a industrial design work, and that's inconsistent with the Copyright Act. I think although this case arose in a 2D context and involves fashion, the implications are likely to be greater in the case of three-dimensional works for a couple of reasons. First, the three-dimensional work cases are historically tougher to resolve because those are the cases where this conceptual separability test, you know, used to come into play, and it's kind of harder to draw that line of, you know, what's protectable because it's design and what's not protectable because it's function. I think the impact here will be important because this conceptual separability test has now, you know, been eliminated in favor of this new test. Cases of industrial design, I think, are easy to imagine where an entire work could be perceived as sculptural, but it's also simultaneously functional. But I don't know that that would necessarily be a bad outcome because other copyright protections would still only, you know, prevent a second designer from making the same or substantially similar design because, you know, things like the originality requirements or independent creation or the idea expression dichotomy and so forth would kick in to prevent overbroad protections. And the one example that you may have seen floating around in 3D printing forums and on various IP and tech blogs is that of the Studio G's Bird's Nest Egg Cup. It's this artistically designed egg cup that's made of these artfully arranged branches that hold the egg in place. And there's a small bird perched on one of the branches. And if you apply the Supreme Court test, arguably the entire cup could be, with the bird, could be extracted and imagined as a separate three-dimensional work of art, and it could be eligible for copyright protection as such. And so it, the entire article could be protected by copyright. But again, that doesn't mean that the rest of the world's egg cup producers would be barred from producing egg cups that look like bird's nests, just egg cups that look like that particular bird's nest. Bottom line is, though, that the Supreme Court didn't address this scenario and didn't address these more complicated 3D type scenarios. And I think this is where the bulk of the action will be as cases are litigated in the future. With regard to fashion, this particular decision would seem to be most readily applicable to parts of the industry that specialize in designs of things like uniforms and other specialized apparel, whether it's something like evening wear or military wear, camouflage, wedding apparel, things like that, and less so to the designers of mass market fashion because there's still no way to extend the protections of the decision and of copyright law to the cut and to the style of a garment. And I think, moreover, just as a very practical matter, given the time involved and the cost incurred of bringing federal copyright claims, such claims are only really going to be attractive in industries where the designs are more standardized or evergreen, such as the ones I mentioned. It doesn't seem worth investing the money if, because of the time involved, the investments of time and money combined, you're going to get a victory that will give you protection for, you know, yesterday's look if you're in a fast-paced, low-margin industry like mass market fashion. So I'll stop there and open the floor to any questions or comments.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Let's go to our first question. Go ahead, caller. Caller, I think you might be on mute.
Hey, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Great, thank you. David Emerson, Berkeley Federal Society. Thank you for the presentation. I'm curious whether there was any discussion or guidance, or if you have any thoughts on just how, as a practical matter, substantial similarity would be evaluated in the context of an actual trial or lawsuit over copyright infringement, in view of the decision's emphasis on the imagination being used. It has to be the copyrightable elements being imagined separately from the useful article and stripping out the utilitarian features. And how is someone who has been tasked with determining substantial similarity going to grapple with an imaginary concept of separability like this?
You raise a very good question, and one the court didn't give any guidance on. And I think that's what I was alluding to with this example of the egg cup at the end. I think that's where the action is going to be, and that we're likely to see cases, particularly in the 3D context, addressing that very issue, because there's really not a lot of guidance or any guidance, I would say, in this case as to how to apply that test where you have to evaluate something like substantial similarity. This is really kind of, I would say, this is the precursor to getting to apply substantial similarity. Right? This is establishing that you have a valid copyright that you can even assert a claim of infringement on. And then the next step would be the substantial similarity test in the context of infringement. Arguably you could say that once you get past this barrier of having established a valid copyright in the plaintiff, you would address substantial similarity as you've always addressed substantial similarity, which may be to say still a muddle sometimes, but it may be that these two issues don't overlap as much as some may be suggesting, just because of the course of where they're addressed in litigation.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next question, I'll ask one of my own. Was this an unexpected outcome?
So I won't say that it was an unexpected outcome necessarily. I would say this was a very anticipated case. And if you listen to the oral arguments, some of the questions that were asked were very much reflected in the opinions, particularly Ginsburg's concurrence and Breyer's and Kennedy's dissent. The majority, I would say, was harder to call exactly where that was going to come out. I think the court did a good job of clearing up the landscape by providing at least a single test. But my wish would have been that they provided a little bit more guidance in how to apply it, but it's because they took up this case, which is a fairly straightforward case in which to apply this test, that there wasn't as much room for such guidance. But, the flip side of that is if you have a dissenting opinion that's, in the very case where you announce this new test, you've got two justices who can't agree on whether the test was met or not, you might have set up a pretty tough to apply test after all. So a long-winded answer to a short question, an anticipated opinion, expected in some ways, unexpected in others, and unexpected results potentially to follow, I guess, would be the short answer.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Professor. This is Michelle Roberts calling in from New York. Just a quick point of clarification on the dissent. During arguments, counsel for the petitioners, Borsch, spent a lot of time trying to persuade the court that these chevron and triangular designs were what made the cheerleading uniform a cheerleading uniform. It
right.
sounds like he was successful in persuading the dissent that that was the case. Is that your take on it?
Yes, the dissent clearly felt that the design could not be separated and separately imagined from the uniform, and went through a number of reasons why.
Great. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for another question, I'll go ahead and give an announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Thursday, April 6th. That call will feature a discussion of the Supreme Court case Lucas v. South Carolina Coastal Council after 25 years. That call will feature James S. Burling, Vice President of Litigation at the Pacific Legal Foundation, Professor Eric R. Clays, Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School, and Professor Michael A. Wolf, Professor of Law and Richard E. Nelson Chair in Local Government at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any more audience questions, I'll ask one of my own. Has the court given us any pointers for the future of copyright law?
So I guess I spoke a little bit about this in answering your last question. I think the evolution of how this separability test will be applied in other cases is hard to predict, and the court hasn't really given us a lot of pointers as to how to apply the test that they set out. And the facts of the case here were such that they didn't lend themselves to as much of a in-depth analysis as would otherwise be the case. There was a good deal of of that kind of analysis in some of the lower court opinions, but having set forth this new test, the majority kind of dispensed with applying it pretty quickly and easily. Although, as noted, the dissent had trouble applying the test as readily as the majority did, and struggled with it somewhat, and felt that it could not separate the chevrons and designs as a separate work of art from the uniform. So I think we will see more cases in the future that will define the borders of this kind of new strand of separability analysis, particularly in the 3D world.
Great. I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum conference calls. And you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Not seeing any questions, Professor, would you like to make some final remarks?
No, just to thank you for the invitation, and good luck to any and all Federalist Society members who are following these issues or working in these industries.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of her valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.